It's Steve Cochran. Before we get to the bonus show podcast here, recorded this conversation with Michael Auslan on a day when we had a testy, to put it mildly, phone line. I encourage you to hang with it because Joe has done some fantastic editing here. And it is listenable, but get through it, and you're going to get some great information from one of my favorite guests, Michael Auslan, the guest today on the Steve Cochran Bonus Show. Michael Auslan joins me, author of End of the Asian Century, but more important for this particular thing, other than you should go out and get the book and get some for your friends, is the fact that nobody knows the Asian region better, and, well, the positives and negatives of what we're doing and what we're not doing. How are you, Michael?
Doing well, Steve. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate you being on, as always. All right, so Donald Trump goes there for a second summit. You know, we lived in a world where we didn't expect there would be a first. Let's start with the somewhat obvious, but not so obvious to everybody. What does this mean to Kim Jong-un to get repeated photo ops and presence of the United States president?
Well, it's huge. In some ways, that's the main goal. I mean, look, they've got the nukes. And they have the missiles, and they've been building towards these things for decades, and not just us. I mean, no one in the world has done anything to stop them. You would think, you know, above all, the South Koreans would have done something to stop them, mm-hmm. but they didn't do it, and the Japanese didn't, and the Chinese didn't do it. Anyway, so, you know, we can pile on the United States, which I've done with you many times for failed diplomacy, but the fact is they had these nukes. So what do they want after that? Well, they want to be taken as a normal state, right? They want the world to see them not as some sort of crazy hermit rogue regime, but rather as a power, if not a great power, like everyone else, right? Because if you have nukes, you're sort of a great power. So what we've seen over the past couple of years, and you really, I mean, honestly, you have to give Kim Jong-un credit for this amazing diplomatic triumph, is what we have seen is basically the creeping normalization of North Korea in the world, not just with the U.S., because he has sat down twice with the U.S. president, but with China, with South Korea, with Russia and Japan, all countries that have said they want to meet with him. This is not the North Korea of 5, 10 years ago, where you never knew if you were going to meet anyone from there. Now he's traveling around. He's, by the way, the first North Korean leader to leave North Korea other than to go to China in the past half century, right? I mean, he's been in Singapore now, he's been in Hanoi. Obviously, the next logical step is a meeting somewhere in Europe, if he will take the plane, which he doesn't like to do, but somewhere he's done it, obviously, to go to Singapore, but somewhere in Europe or, you know, dare we say it, in the United States.
It's the Steve Cochran Bonus Show podcast here. We're talking with Michael Auslan about Kim Jong-un, about North Korea, and about us. All right, so the president goes there for a second summit. You know how I feel about this. I don't believe the president has a policy. I believe Mike Pompeo has a policy. I believe the administration might have a spoken policy, but it's up to him, the president, to run with it. And I believe, with all sincerity, that Donald Trump's policy is what will make Donald Trump look good. That's greatly dangerous. He leaves without a deal. I think that's the accidental upside to this. But he also, to me, felt like he took the second chair here. In other words, if I sit down with Kim Jong-un once, twice, and I'm the American president, I'm going to say, this is what you have to do to have a relationship with us, not, hey, what do you got, Kim? Isn't that the kind of the way it played out?
Yeah, I think it did. And I mean, to put it in a little bit of historical perspective, Steve, from my, you know, viewpoint, this is actually what U.S. presidents have been doing for a long time. It is, as with everything with Donald Trump, I think, exacerbated by, you know, his particular personality and the way that he goes about these things. But if you look at the Clinton administration, sorry, it was Jimmy Carter who sort of brokered this deal in 1994 with them. You know, they sent Madeleine Albright to meet Kim Jong-il, and they really desperately wanted to get Bill Clinton in a room with Kim Jong-il, and they just couldn't put it together before he left office. You know, it's really, I think Trump is not the only president who has gone in a way that actually it has dealt with the North Koreans in a way that's actually made them look more serious. And in fact, no one has really put the pressure on the North Koreans in a way that is sustained and over the long term. Clinton threatened a military attack, a bombing attack on their very back then in 1994, very, very nascent nuclear facilities such as they were. And that would have set them back for a very long time, but he didn't do it. That was one set of pressure, but then they came to the table and they sort of ran rings around us, and that agreement fell apart pretty quickly. The Bush administration put very serious financial sanctions on the North Koreans, but particularly on the family, and that brought them squealing back to the table. But then we dropped it again because we really thought they could get a deal through. Everyone goes through this cycle, I think, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Now, the sanctions that Trump put on North Korea were actually quite significant. They were stronger. It's funny because on the one hand, you think, well, what could be left to sanction, right? We've been sanctioning these guys for a quarter century.
But right.
They always find something new. And of course, the reality is that the sanctions are always undercut by China and Russia. And in some cases, actually, by South Korea, who turns a blind eye, at least under this current administration. But the point is that we put pressure on and then we back off. And the sanctions that Trump put on were actually quite significant, were absolutely harming the economy. And we should remember that the North Korean economy, while not like our economy, on its own terms, was actually doing fairly well a few years ago. They had really stabilized it. And these sanctions started to bite. And unfortunately, again, we have reduced the effectiveness of these sanctions and certainly have gotten no support or help from China or Russia or the like. So, Trump amped it up, right? And he really went, they decided, I think they even gave a quote like this, they decided to go big. Which is certainly his personality. But if you look at the substance of what they've been doing and the mistakes, I would say, it's really not that different from what other presidents have done, which goes to your point of saying, this is what you need to do in order to have a good relationship with us, as opposed to, what can we do to keep you at the table? And we just seem to get caught back in that trap all the time.
There's no reason to trust this family. There's no reason to trust the military or the leadership of North Korea. I don't know how many times we have to relive that message, as you've just laid out so well. But I am intrigued to hear that Japan, I understand why China and South Korea have direct interest. China, from an economic standpoint, and certainly for their own self-defense, but South Korea certainly needs to have a peaceful coexistence with North Korea. Russia, I automatically assume the worst from Russia. But
right.
What is Japan's purpose other than hoping they're not going to fly missiles over Japan?
Well, that's it. I mean, so it's a couple of different things that are going on with Japan. First is the very long-standing enmity between the Koreas and Japan. So right now you have a terrible frozen relationship between South Korea and Japan, and one where there's actually been, even believe it or not, some sort of low-level military jockeying between the two, which is very worrisome. Now multiply that by, 100. And the North Koreans, hate the Japanese still, of course, for the colonization of Korea. But it's been a bogeyman for them. They have kidnapped Japanese citizens off the shores of Japan back in the 1970s and 1980s, the so-called abductees. They have flown missiles over Japan. They've had spy boats that have penetrated into Japanese waters. So for the Japanese, this is a regime that is a threat, and it has been for a very long time. Now you make it a nuclear regime, and Japan doesn't have nuclear weapons. It has to depend on the United States. So let's say the North Koreans do have the purported 25 to 60 nuclear weapons. That's sort of the range that we get in the open information from the U.S. intelligence agencies. Well, there's basically four main cities in Japan, right? There's Tokyo, Yokohama, Osaka, and Fukuoka. So the North Koreans, who have been perfecting their ballistic missile technology for decades now, and Japan is much closer to the United States, meaning it's a lot easier to get a missile there, as they've shown by flying missiles over the islands. if you have only 4 or 5 major cities and North Korea has, you know, 20, 25, 50 nuclear weapons, it's an existential threat. So the Japanese are very invested and have been very invested in this whole process with the United States. They were part of the six-party talks back under the Bush administration. Of course, if there were any military conflict with North Korea between the United States and North Korea, the bulk of our military forces are in Japan. You know, we have what you'd call a tripwire in South Korea, 28,000 or so troops, but the bulk of what we have in the region is coming from Japanese territory. So the Japanese would be drawn into that war right away, and they know that, and the North Koreans know it. So once again, you don't even need nuclear missiles in order to wreak havoc and cause massive casualties in Japan, just as you would in Seoul. The North Koreans can launch their intermediate range ballistic missiles at Japan and strike Japanese cities. So they're a very interested partner in all of this and a steadfast ally. The problem, I would say, for Japan, the problem for South Korea, even though we can talk about this as a different government right now, is that they've watched the United States for a quarter century fail to stop North Korea from getting nuclear weapons. And this was a tiny, impoverished state, North Korea. And now, after 25 years, it has nuclear weapons and the ballistic missiles that can deliver them.
So what is the, not the end game, but even the middle game here? They're not going to denuclearize because that secures the family's power. And the minute they do, it's over. So is the goal, and I know we've talked about the goal, and it's not exactly clear even now, is the goal beyond having a seat, even at the child's table in world discussions, is the goal to have sanctions drop because they're in tough shape? And if so, what's the incentive to drop sanctions if they won't denuke? Because even when they said they would, we find out there's hidden missile sites. The development continues all the time.
Yeah, and in fact, that last point that's going on right now, we've identified more nuclear development sites. So one thing the Trump administration keeps touting is that North Korea has not done a missile or nuclear test in 18 months or whatever it is. And that's important. But number one, that doesn't mean that they're not continuing testing. And I've heard some talk that they may have high-speed computers just like we do so that they can model nuclear tests and therefore they don't actually need to set it off. So on the one hand, it's not that they've stopped their development program. Second thing is, given this breakdown in talks, there is a chance that North Korea will go back to that testing to say, look, we're really serious and you have to come back to the table. They have done that in the past. Now, whether Kim Jong-un wants to risk that with Donald Trump, we'll wait and see. So you're right that the threat continues. What do they want? Well, I think you start with the simplest and the first order issue. Kim Jong-un wants to survive. And he wants his regime to survive. So a little while before, you said, we can't trust the regime. And that's exactly right. And yet, if we understand that he wants to survive, then we also understand what some of the leverage is that we may have over him. And we've taken that leverage away by promising not to seek regime change and not to obviously, in the ultimate extreme, we have the military option. We've never dropped that. But for the most part, we said, look, we're not going to be thinking about doing an attack on you, changing the regime. You know, the military option would be at the very end. So you take away your leverage against making him worry that he may not wake up tomorrow morning. And in fact, I would argue, if you look at the early months of the Trump administration, what really freaked them out was that Trump was talking about fire and fury and brimstone and destroying these guys, and no American president had talked like that. And then before you know it, they go to the South Koreans and say, hey, we want to meet with him. So then the backtracking, which is to assure them of their existence, is again takes away leverage. So what do they want? They want to survive above all. Secondly, they want to be in a position where the pressure to denuclearize is off of them. In essence, what they've done is normalized their relations and been accepted as a nuclear power. And then third, you know, they want the seat at the table. Now, whether they want it in a way that a normal state does, meaning they always want to be invited to international fora and the like, I'm not quite sure. But they certainly want to be part of a global system on their own terms, meaning they'll show up when they want, they'll try to get things such as more sanctions or more trade or more access to the international banking system, whatever it is, when they want it. And they're actually achieving most of those things. So we're at a sort of crisis point. I think we've been there for a while, but we're at a sort of crisis point with U.S. policy, which is, you know, do you go down the road of saying, well, we're not going to be able to denuclearize them short of war, and we're not going to launch that war, so unless they make a mistake, we're going to live with the North Korea and nuclear weapons, and you got to figure out how to do that? Or do you say what we really haven't done is this sustained pressure of sanctions as much as we possibly can and inserting as much uncertainty into Kim Jong-un's mind so that at a minimum we try to box him in and contain him, and at a maximum we get him so worried that he actually thinks, okay, you know, these weapons aren't worth it for me to survive. But, you know, I don't think we've chosen either path. And as you point out, by the way, last thing, Steve, as you point out, they watched very carefully, as everyone did, what happened to Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi. Sure. When Muammar Gaddafi gave up his weapons and Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons. So the idea that they're going to easily make a calculation, that they got to give these things up, I think is certainly not proved by history.
Yeah, and I think the word accident is key here, and I'll let you go on this, but again, verify or counter this point, and that is that an accident is the greatest danger that we have, because any nuclear strike will be met with multiplicity of force by us, by others. And that's the end of the Kim family. That's the end of North Korea as they know it. So our greatest concern is that somebody's going to make a huge mistake and either appear to be the first strike that isn't the first strike or have some horrific testing accident. That's the danger in them having this ability now, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've probably talked about this before. That's actually the great fear that I have, is that you know, neither side is going to choose war willfully. I mean, it may happen, but, you know, again, the North Koreans want to survive, and we're a very risk-averse nation overall. But having nuclear weapons is a very difficult proposition. We make mistakes all the time. The Soviets made mistakes. We've had dozens of accidents. We have nuclear bombs that fell from airplanes during the Cold War that we still haven't found, right? So the North Koreans having a nuclear force is a very scary and dangerous proposition. You have to make sure that your people are trained, that your weapons are safe, that you're not having some accident where, you know, say an accident on North Korean soil, and then wind up blaming the Japanese or the Americans. A missile gets launched off by someone who doesn't know his job and is panicking. This is really a terrifying proposition. So unless you can denuclearize them, you have to live with an enormous amount of uncertainty because we don't understand at all how they're going to manage their nuclear weapons. And you have to start thinking outside the box. I mean, you know, I want them to be denuclearized, and I want the Kim regime to go, but if that's not going to happen, you may have to think about how you, believe it or not, help make North Korean nukes safer, not because we want them to have a good nuclear program, but because we don't want these things causing some type of nuclear exchange or massive war. So, again, we have come to, I don't know if we're at the end of the road of diplomacy, but we've certainly gone a long way down it over the past 25 years. The Trump administration, I think that the bottom line, Steve, is that Trump, and not without reason, looked at this situation and said, look, I can make a deal. You know, obviously, that seems to be the way he approaches the world. But his deal-making is based on personality and personal relationships, right? And all of the diplomacy under Republicans and Democrats had fallen short. It just did not get us where we wanted to be. And so I think instinctively, probably, he decided on a new tack, which was to go big, go directly to the top, try to create this relationship with Kim Jong-un that was going to provide a new type of pressure, i.e. the personal relationship that we had never had before. That was put to the test in Hanoi, and it failed in Hanoi. I don't know if that means it's failed entirely, but as you pointed out at the very top of this, you know, it's better to walk away from a bad agreement, as Reagan did in Reykjavik in 1986, than plunge ahead with a good agreement. And clearly, Trump and the administration understood that. The question is, where do you go from here? Do you go back to the old model of saying, all right, this is just very tiresome spade work, you know, at the low-level diplomatic angle to just try to build this up? Or do you double down on saying we started a personal relationship and it didn't work out this time, but it's the best path forward? And quite frankly, you know, we don't have a lot of other options to deal with North Korea.
Yeah, it appears to be the only answer at this point. So I would love having Michael Oslin on because he takes this really scary stuff and scares us even more. Michael is the inaugural Williams Griffiths Fellow in Contemporary Asia at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and an author, of course, author of The End of the Asian Century. And I hope you get a very readable account of that part of the world, which is incredibly vital and changing probably as fast as any other part of the world right now, if not more so. And Michael, I look forward to talking to you again.
Anytime, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for hanging through that. Listen early, listen often, tell your friends. The Steve Cochran Bonus Show podcast available here and wherever you get podcasts. Tell your friends. And we will have exciting guests, interesting guests, occasionally lame guests on this every single week. Thank you again, and listen to the regular Steve Cochran Show. It's morning, 6 to 10 a.m. on my favorite radio station, 720 WGN and WGNRadio.com.